Welcome to the WGBH Forum Network weekly lecture series. From politics to poetry, science to satire, listen in and enjoy.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
This is the WGBH Forum Network.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum with Swanee Hunt discussing her memoir, Half-Life of a Zealot. My name is Clark Apt, and I'm going to give you a little bit of information about Swanee. Swanee's new memoir, Half-Life of a Zealot, is a candid and compassionate account of her path from a childhood of privilege, challenged by a powerful and demanding dad, challenged by and inspired by her mother's deep Christian faith, to become a leading philanthropist, teacher, ambassador, and reformer, dedicated to empowering women and oppressed minorities everywhere and achieving peaceful resolutions of conflicts worldwide. I often wonder what has influenced Swanee Hunt to identify with women of the war-torn and impoverished corners of the globe. How has she learned to use her position of wealth and power for social reform so effectively? We're going to hear something about that. If you're as interested as I am in Swanee's family background and conflicts, her insights and initiatives in anti-poverty, education, international conflict resolution, philanthropy, diplomacy, modern European and American history, mental health, marriage and work conflicts, women's changing roles and advancement, and the ethics of personal responsibility. These are all themes that are universal and intensely argued these days. If you're as interested as I am in all of these, and I believe many of you are, you'll be stirred deeply by reading her book's tale of public and personal triumphs and some tragedies. So, Swanee is the director of the Women's Public Policy Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and chairs the Initiative for Inclusive Security, including the Women Waging Peace Network, where she's brought women leaders from all over the world to Cambridge, and she has a network going out to support women's leadership advancement. She's a member of the U.S. Council of Foreign Relations and a member of the board of the Crisis Group and is president of the Hunt Alternative Fund. Her previous book was Not Our War, Bosnian Women Reclaiming the Peace. This was Not Our War. I've read this one too, and it's really excellent. And her biography, her autobiography, doesn't go into the detail on her key role in resolving the Yugoslav conflict in the early 1990s. This book does. And it's available here. That book grew out of her experience as an ambassador to Austria during the Clinton administration, in which she played a major role in the Yugoslav conflict. Welcome to Cambridge Forum, Swanee Hunt.
No, it's fine. I'm going to keep it right there. Okay. Is this okay? better, right? Good. I just don't fit behind these, so I try to make my environment fit me. That's, I guess, one of the themes of the book. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it a lot. Clark, I was thinking as you were introducing me just how wonderful it is to go from the tennis courts to a setting like this. Clark is a very dear friend, and Wendy, and I appreciate you introducing me to this group, and this is your space, I think, of Cambridge. And Charles and I have been here. Charles is over there, symphony conductor, conductor of the Boston Landmarks Orchestra. We've been here now for 9 years. And in fact, this church is where my cantata has been performed a couple of times, so I do have a feeling very much of being at home here too. The book, 9 years in the writing. It was Charles's idea. He gets at least the blame, if I get the credit. I had no intention of writing a book until I was coming back from Vienna, and I was bursting with experiences from that time there and trying to make sense of it, coming here to be at the Kennedy School. And as I got a little bit of distance from that experience, I realized that part of what had happened to me there is that I had gone from one level of responsibility and reflection and had just jumped up 6 levels. And then that led me here to the Kennedy School. And so I thought, how did this happen? And I actually became quite introspective, trying to figure out what had happened in my life. And it took me going back and peeling the layers back and back and back. And then finally I decided that this story of a girl trying to find her voice as I became a woman and then trying to think of who all am I and what all can I do in the world as I became more confident, that wasn't just my story. That was a common story. And as I began teaching at the Kennedy School, I kept recognizing in my students that same kind of question of, you know, especially at Harvard, you know, students saying to themselves, you know, I'm really smart and I have all these connections. You know, what am I going to do in the world? How do I live with myself in a way? How do I live with myself with all of this privilege? Even if they didn't have money, to have just those kinds of IQ and educational opportunities. I mean, I'll tell you, that's worth a fortune. That's really worth a fortune. So how do I live with myself? And I think being over there at the Kennedy School in that environment made me particularly want to go back and see the thread. So here's what it looks like. I was born in 1950 in Dallas, and people think of me now as being from this very wealthy oil and gas family. Actually, my father was my mother's mistress. I'm not telling any secrets that weren't already known. What's new in this book is my telling how it felt from the inside of that scene. So my father had no formal education. Education, by the way, to you Cambridge folk, education was not a value in the Hunt family. I mean, in fact, my brother told his 5 kids they could go to any school in the world as long as it wasn't one of the Ivy League. You know, so my father had no formal education, and he was taught at home by his mother, and when he was in maybe 12 years old or 13, he jumped on a railroad car and went out west and from Illinois and was a short order cook and a lumberjack and laid railroad and planted eucalyptus, and you know. And then his father died and he inherited $10,000. And with that, he bought some land and he swapped some land and he bought and he swapped and he bought and he swapped, grew cotton and made a little fortune and lost a little fortune. And then started over and he was a gambler. He was a card shark. And somehow or another, he got himself into that rough and tumble oil and gas world in East Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, that triangle there. And he ended up in a deal buying out Dad Joyner, Dad Joyner, who had leases all over the place, but he actually had sold about 400% of the returns from any successes he found in his oil drilling. So he was in trouble. And Dad bought his wells, and that turned out to be the discovery well of the East Texas oil field, which was the largest oil field in the world, pre-Middle East, right? So here you have this man who has no education formally. I mean, when he would talk, he would say things like, well, he don't know which way is up. You know, I mean, I never saw my dad hold a book, ever. I mean, except for one that he wrote about his political point of view. I never saw him hold a book. And here he is, considered by some the richest man in America, maybe the richest man in the world, for all they knew. But no one could quite figure out. Now, he had a family of six, and then he had another mother of his children, of other children, six more, and those ages were interspersed. I say it that way because no one knows if he was married or not to the other woman. She said yes, he said no. There was a trial. We settled out of court. You know, I don't know what the answer is. They broke up, and he met my mother, who was a secretary in the law firm that was doing his leases. Mom, raised in Idabel, Oklahoma, on a farm. She had five older siblings. They were so poor that none of them could go to college. They didn't all finish high school. But Mom finished high school, and her older sibs decided that they would all pool their money to give her an education, college. So she had a year and a half at Oklahoma State University, which was enough to become a secretary. She's 30 years younger than my father. He meets her, he seduces her, she becomes pregnant. He flies her up from Shreveport, Louisiana, where she was living, to New York City, and all alone on the Upper West Side near Columbia, all alone she lives as she gets ready to have this baby and gives birth without anyone. Her mother didn't know where she was. No one in her family knew where she was. She had just disappeared. So I was raised the first 7 or 8 years in a middle-class house, 5 minutes from the big mansion where my father lived. My father would come visit. I had no idea who he was. I was told that my father was in the Foreign Service somewhere, and that's why I never saw him. I was the youngest of all the children. So my mother was my father's mistress for 13 years before his wife died, and he moved her and us into the big mansion. And one of my memories is passing him. I was trying to figure, I got lost the first day I was there. I got lost and I crossed paths with him, and he looked at me and he said, "Which one are you?" I mean, that's what it was like. And he had married my mother, and then he adopted us kids, which I thought was rather redundant. But he then tired of the oil and gas business and became the most ardent anti-communist. He made the John Birch Society look liberal. I mean, there was a communist running this church, okay? There were certainly communists running Harvard and Radcliffe, because I wanted to go to Radcliffe, and he said, "No, you can't, because it's run by communists." And then he said, "You're going to SMU, Southern Methodist University." Then he said, "It's run by communists too, but at least it's only 10 minutes from the house." So that was our life. Everything was about the communists. Everything. You go back in the archives of 60 Minutes and you see Mike Wallace trying to ask Dad questions, and it doesn't matter what the question is, every answer is about the communists. Now, so here's this political father on this wave, this social wave. He's a friend of Joe McCarthy's and Douglas MacArthur. And then you got my mother, who dealt with her conflict by devoting herself to the church, not just any church, the Southern Baptist Church. And First Baptist Church of Dallas became her place. We were there 18 hours a week, Oh, that's a lot. In case you're trying to figure out how you do that. Now, I know there are a couple of people in this audience who could identify with this. But, you know, that to get 18 hours in, that's more than Sunday, okay? That's Tuesday night witnessing. That's where you take an index card of someone who's new to town, and you go visit them and ask them if they know the four spiritual laws and sit down with them and explain that Jesus died to save them and they're a sinner. And anyway, and then Wednesday night is prayer meeting, and you're learning about missions, girls auxiliary, and you have choir all throughout the week. And I mean, it was just great. It was great. For every question, there was an answer. And there was only one answer, right? There was just one answer, and the issue was, do you have the faith? It wasn't, can you figure this out? It's, do you have the faith? And it was great. When you come from a home that has as much tension as ours did, and it had a lot, because Dad's pattern with women didn't stop with my mother, okay, as you wouldn't expect it to. So when you come from that kind of heartbreak, and you can go to a place where it says, Jesus is all the world to me, my life, my joy, my all. I mean, it's wonderful. And you know what? You had the conservative politics, and then you had the conservative evangelicals, and they met in a big bang at First Baptist Church of Dallas, and out came the religious right. Yeah, that's where it was born. I just, as much as any place in the world. And I felt like I was right in the middle. I was like the little kid standing there watching it being born. And but then there was Martin Luther King on TV. Remember, I was born in 1950. So here I am turning on the television, and all of the conflicts I try to describe in here about what it's like having the maids, right? The colored maids. And trying to understand what their lives are like in South Dallas, and trying to put that together. And you know, we used to sing songs in church like, does it make any difference to you? Does it make any difference to you if a soul dies in sin? God has called you to win. Does it make any difference to you? Will his blood be required at thy hand? Oh, Lord, that is hard. That is really hard for a 12-year-old to be asking questions like, so now let me get this straight, Sunday school teacher. If the people in Africa, if they die and they've never even heard of Jesus, I'm like, if they're in the deep, deep, deep jungle, they've never heard the word Jesus, they're going to go to hell too, eternally? Well, that's why you ought to go to them, Swanee, dear. That's why you should, you know, give your life to making sure, because they will burn in hell because you didn't go. And, wow, that's really something. I mean, that's the weight of the world. That is, do you all understand? I mean, up here, a beast, we don't really get this about the evangelical movement. That, do you understand that if you believe that another person is going to burn in hell eternally because they have not had a chance, or they don't know the Lord, you don't sit around and watch sitcoms all day. I mean, not if you have any kind of sense of responsibility or caring. I mean, you're compelled. And we grew up with that sense of compelling. And I think that we make a real mistake in our political liberalism to think of this, you know, we are somehow the righteous ones, and they are the uncaring. I mean, you know, they're the ones who are turning out on Tuesday nights to go witnessing. At any rate, at some point I thought, well, does it make any difference to me that people are homeless? Does it make any difference to me that kids, you know, 30,000 kids died today of preventable illnesses, according to the UN? Today, 30,000 kids died of dirty water and preventable diseases. So anyway, I made a transition into certainly a more liberal kind of political place. And at some point, my sister and I said, you know, Forbes magazine says that our family has a lot of money, but we sure aren't seeing it. I mean, my father was very, very modest. He took his lunch to work in a brown paper sack. So when after he died and my brother built the company, rebuilt the company, and he was a great businessman, he still controlled all of the company, and that was hard. And so eventually we were able to negotiate a restructuring. And my sister and I decided we would start a foundation, a philanthropic foundation. And we didn't want it to be identified with Hunt because we didn't feel like we identified with Hunt, given the politics of the family. And so we said any name but Hunt, but we couldn't think of a good name. We applied some friends with wine, and they came up with a name. How about Hunt's Catch Up? Hunt's Catch Up. Well, no. But we said, okay, Hunt Alternatives Fund, because they can then, the public can decide whether we do alternative funding or whether we are alternative hunts. And that worked really well. And I was very, very involved in this foundation, now living in Denver, Colorado, because I couldn't live in Dallas. And suddenly, the political world descended on me, because I was co-directing a halfway house for mentally ill people. I didn't mention to you that in our household was my half-brother Hassie, who was paranoid schizophrenic and lobotomized, my father's oldest son. And I try to describe that in the book. So my first husband, Mark, and I are co-directing this halfway house for mentally ill people, and I just see how messed up, really messed up, the mental health system is. So I have to get involved with the mayor and start advocacy. And then the governor says, come direct a coordinating council for housing and homelessness. So I say, okay, you know, and that feels really great. But I'm not going to get involved in presidential politics. I'm sorry. I just give me the city council to work on. I know those people. School board, great, but not presidential. And I was watching the 92 Republican convention, the Pat Buchanan speech. I'm a convert. I mean, I'll tell you, I watched probably with the same feeling that my father watched Khrushchev banging his shoe at the UN. Seriously, do you remember that? The We Will Bury You? Well, go back and read Pat Buchanan's speech at the Republican convention. And he's talking about there's a culture war and we've got to take back our country from the perverts. I mean, you know, it's just, and I said, oh, I think I have to get involved. I really do. I don't think I can sit out this one. And I called the Democratic National Committee and said, I want to help. And they didn't call me back. So I called the DNC again. I said, I really, really want to help. I didn't get a call back. It reminds me of Mark Twain's comment, I belong to no organized party, I'm a Democrat. Yeah. Well, so I called a third time, and finally I called Tim Worth, who was our senator. I said, Tim, I really want to help. He said, oh, you do? This is great. And he got me a call back, and I became real involved, put on a women's symposium, and Hillary and Tipper spoke, and we did an all-day. We called it Serious Issues, Serious Women, Serious Money, raised $1 million. And out of that came my relationship with Hillary. And that has been a wonderful relationship for me. And I talk about that throughout the second half of the book. Just, yeah, she's the person who said, oh, why don't you, you know, do this? And Pat Schroeder was my congresswoman in Denver, and she came to see me, and I said, I think I'm going to go to Washington and work on welfare reform. She said, no, you're not. I said, oh, but I am. She said, no, you're not. Not with a 5-year-old and an 11-year-old. She said, you go to Washington, you leave your desk before 9 o'clock, there'll be someone else sitting in it the next morning. She said, you know, unless you're one of the top two priorities of the president, you're going to be waiting in line with sharp-elbowed 22-year-olds for a photo op at the Rose Garden. Doesn't that sound like Pat Schroeder? You know? She said, you need to head an embassy. And I was flabbergasted. So we talked a while. I said, no, Pat, there's no way. And she said, well, why not? And I said, look, number one, I've lived in Germany for 4 years. I speak German, but I'm not a foreign policy person. I do domestic policy. And then second, I can't because I gave a huge contribution. And she said, Swanee, who do you think goes to London, Paris, Vienna, and Rome? And I said, I'm a member of Common Cause, and I have been a member for 10 years of Common Cause, and I do not believe in people buying embassies or any other appointment. She said, you know, Swanee, grow up. I said, Pat, no, seriously, if I did that, anything I did after that, people would say, you know, well, it's because of her money. And she said, Swanee, they already say that. You know, I said, oh my gosh, she had an answer. That if you know Pat Schroeder, she has an answer for everything. Anyway, I talked and talked with Charles, and he said, you really have to go for this. You can do this. And what I discovered after I became ambassador and ended up in Vienna and looked around for the inner city, which is where I'd been working in Denver, I looked around for the inner city. Austria was doing fine. Austria was just fine. You know, they didn't have the kind of social problems that we did. It's kind of a miracle. But Yugoslavia, right next door, there were 70,000 refugees who were streaming across the border into Austria. And I recognized their stories because the trauma and the atrocities, and I mean, first of all, it sounded like 50 years earlier under Hitler. But I also said, you know, these are homeless people. These are battered people. And I realized that what we think of as foreign policy is actually other people's domestic policy. That was an amazing thing to realize. And I actually had some basic principles that helped me fare pretty well. Listen, you'll have to read the book to get much more. But I do want to take you into one scene, if I may. May I do that? Because I can get pretty heavy in terms of people ought to be giving their lives for this and that, and you know we've got to right the injustice of the world. But my kids always kept lightening things up, and that's a great thing about kids. You know, they just never let you take yourself too seriously. So here's the scene I'd like to bring to you. I've just been at a reception. First of all, the embassy had 500 employees and 14 departments. It was a big management job. And in addition, there was all kinds of public face to it. I see another ambassador in this audience. And the U.S. ambassador is this really big wig. So, I mean, just generally speaking, because we were the lone superpower. So at this reception, I was standing next to the Jordanian ambassador, and we were going to have to stand there for 30 minutes waiting for the president of Austria to come in, and his tie was crooked. Now, I don't know about you. I mean, like, it was real crooked. It wasn't, like, just barely crooked. It was, like, real crooked. I just couldn't bear it. So I said, do you want me to fix your tie? And I reached up to fix his tie, and the camera started flashing, and he told me later he had to speak to his foreign minister. He was called by his foreign minister to explain why this picture of this woman dressing him was all over the Middle East. But anyway, I said to him in that conversation, he mentioned that King Hussein and Queen Noor were going to be in town. I said, you know, I'd love to meet them. And sure enough, like 2 hours later, there's a phone call to our office, and this date is set up the next day. So I'm taking the kids to school, and there's this driver driving us, and I'm talking to the kids in the back, and I say, well, what's on for you? Math test, Lillian grumbled. She was now 12 years old. Spelling quiz, Teddy chirped. He was 6. Okay. Well, I'm going to meet a king and a queen, I threw out. Their interest was at least piqued. So together we made our way to the Imperial Hotel, former Habsburg guest house. I was dressed in a properly ambassadorial suit. Teddy was in sweatpants, red sweatpants. Lil was wearing a t-shirt with a large portrait of Snow White's sidekick, Grumpy. His hands folded in disgust. I insisted that Lil tuck in her shirt. She pushed it into her pants awkwardly as we made our way up the graceful staircase, which guests of the monarchy had descended a century earlier. As we processed, I muttered threats to Teddy. You even mention your strep infection and you're dead. We were shown into an exquisite waiting room for a soft drink and then finally taken past a dozen protocol and security aides to the parlor of Their Majesty's suite. On a table was a large silver tray loaded with fruit. "Have a strawberry if you want," I told the kids. Both declined. Speaking in hushed voices, we continued to wait. Eventually, the tall door opened, and in walked a man with a cropped beard, followed by his willowy, strikingly handsome wife. After a cheerful greeting, we all sat down, we three on a sofa with the monarchs on either end. Lillian was next to Queen Noor, and I was on the king's right with Teddy beside me. King Hussein, perhaps the most gracious man I have ever met, went over to the table, picked up the fruit tray, and held it before us. He kind of bowed like this. Now, Teddy took a giant strawberry, which he proceeded to suck on throughout the hour. Our conversation ranged from Middle East policy to Washington politics. Queen Noor, American-born, questioned me about the Women's Foundation of Colorado. I kept talking with my eyes on her as I felt Teddy take my right hand and deposit the mushy remains of his strawberry. No napkin was within reach as the mix of warm juice and saliva spread across my palm and between my fingers. As we stood to bid farewell, I discreetly dropped the strawberry pulp in the flowers on the table. As a conclusion to our meeting, I assured King Hussein that Americans felt a profound appreciation for his contribution to the Middle East peace process. Tears came to his eyes. This had been the core of his life's work, he said. I was moved by the simple goodness of his vision. "You know, you're what Americans call a real prince," I said spontaneously. Then, seeing the king's tilted head and puzzled look, I paused. "Oh, I guess you're one of the few people in the world for whom that's not a compliment." His Majesty smiled indulgently. He extended his hand to shake mine, red ooze and all. Someone opened the door, and we all filed out into the hallway. Half a dozen photographers were waiting, bunched up, some standing, some kneeling, snapping away. I have a picture of us all on my shelf today, a tall blonde beauty with voluminous hair wearing a hot pink silk blouse and elegant striped suit, a good-looking man with a gray mustache and enchanting smile, his kingly high forehead framing dark eyebrows. I'm in a rather staid brown suit and hat. Lillian's white t-shirt explodes with the dwarf's huge bulbous brown nose and GRUMPY in 3-inch block letters across her chest. And Teddy, strep and all, has his hands casually stuffed in his pockets of his loose sweatpants like a cherubic ruffian. As the five of us stood in a row smiling at the cameras, Her Majesty whispered to me, "So how do you like being an ambassador?" "How do you like being a queen?" I returned. Those were the light moments. Those were the wonderfully lifting moments because the work was very, very, very heavy. It was very intense. It was tough. The other very important strand that I describe in here is my own daughter's development of bipolar. And the multiple times I went from my desk at the embassy to the public hospital, back and forth, where she was sharing a room with a woman who had lost both legs when she'd thrown herself in front of a tram. And just the development of the psychosis, the hallucinations, trying to deal with the medications, the side effects. And someone said to me, "Why don't you do a whole chapter just of your daughter and mental illness. And why don't you do another chapter of the time at the embassy and another chapter of what was happening in Bosnia? And I said, because that's not how I lived it. That's not how any one of us lives it. And there are people here in this audience, and you've come from work, but you know, as you were walking over, you were calling and talking to a family member who is right on the brink. And you've been thinking about that family member all throughout the day, in between checking budgets and proofing texts and whatever else you were doing. And that's how my life was lived as well. And so what I've tried to do is say in here that life must be lived in an integrated way. And we must not try to keep, as if they're secrets, you know, as if the parts of our lives that aren't pretty, that aren't beautiful, that don't work very well, that as if they're not as much part of our life as any success that we have. And I try in this book to be honest about mothering and my failure at times, and how difficult this was on our marriage, and my sense of insecurity, as well as my successes and the times that I felt like, you know, I made it. So, Clark, I'm going to stop there. I know I've gone on for a while, but if a few people have some questions, it's great. And thank you very, very much for letting me go on as I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Swanee, for those insights from the book. I'd like to lead off the discussion with a question of my own, which is, given all that you've learned from balancing motherhood, marital life, professional life, and your reform activities, how would you apply those lessons to the crises of the day, in particularly the oppression of women in Africa and in some of the Muslim countries?
Well, I'm on my way to Liberia, actually, next week to work with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. So I spend a lot of time. I think in February I'll be in Rwanda working with the members of parliament there. There are a lot of victims, right? A lot of women victims out there. But it's really important that we understand that any victim who's alive to tell you about it is actually a survivor. And there is strength that comes out of that experience as well as damage. And so I would rather work on issues, on the problems of women, by elevating women leaders. Because those women leaders will have a particular sensitivity to the problems of women. And if you can get the numbers of women in decision-making up to about 30 or 40%, you start to see some very significant differences in the practices of a parliament or some other institution. So that's one lesson, is that we need to elevate women in decision-making if we want to deal with the problems of women worldwide. And the second is that the best solutions to problems come from the people who are experiencing the problems. That's so basic, but it's usually forgotten. And so you have all kinds of well-intentioned, smart people outside who are imposing these solutions on people in the inner city or in a foreign policy situation. And the policymakers are worlds apart. That's the name of my third book that is about to come out. They're worlds apart from what's happening on the ground. I found that over and over in, whether it was working in Denver or working in Sarajevo. And it applies very much to work anywhere in the world. Find the people who are experiencing the problems and let them design the solutions.
Well, now we have some time for a few questions. Please step up to the mic. You're joining us at Cambridge Forum, listening to Swanee Hunt discuss her latest book, half-life of a zealot. Please.
Hi Swanee. I have a question. Okay, and I don't want you to take it the wrong way, but I'm going to ask you it's a three-part question.
It always makes me quake when people say, I don't want you to take it the wrong way.
No, I see three different realms of your life that you spoke about tonight, and I have a question about when you come from this background of privilege. Do you ever get doubt from people or suspicion about what do you know about people who are really, you know, underprivileged or impoverished, and how can you empathize or relate to them? And the second part of, I see another realm of your life, you know, I lived in Dallas, and you come from, you know, a family that everyone knows of wealth, but also you talk about the side of your mother, and I also live in Dallas, and I know the back talk, and, you know, even within, you know, certain social status, people still think of ways of putting you down. So, and also, how did you deal with that, where people still can cut you down, even being a hunt? And then now you come into this different environment at Harvard, and I'm at Harvard also, and you have this academic elitism that's going on, and here you're coming from a ground level, more, you know, in a practitioner in the field, and you're dealing with those. So I see those three different realms. Which one was the most difficult to deal with, or none of them were?
So. Oh, thank you, Tonya. The very first grant that our foundation gave, Helen's in my foundation, was to the Safe House for Battered Women. And it didn't dawn on me till a couple of years later that, at least in my unconscious, that was the gift from my mother. Because she was really emotionally battered, and she could have been out on the street in a nanosecond with her four kids, trying to figure out what to do. You know, and she couldn't fall back on any family savings or rich relatives. So it has been very important. It was very important to me as an adult to talk with Mother more and more about what that experience was like, and to understand myself not just as a person who could go into a store and charge a lot of clothes if I wanted to. I mean, how many clothes can you wear at one time? Seriously, yeah? But to realize the commonality that I shared. When I came here to Harvard, that was really tricky. Somebody told me that it would be the most dangerous place of my life. So I brought my flak jacket that I'd used in Bosnia. And, you know. But people were very kind to me, actually. I look around and I see people who are very, very successful professors here who are not living lives that they find fulfilling. Yeah? And so what I came to understand is that sense of integrity and meaning, that comes from something else. That comes from inner knowledge of not knowing yourself as a person in relationship. And that cuts at a level that is totally different from education or from wealth. And passion isn't about having money. Passion and a sense of meaning in your life, and zeal, hence zealot, that's about having purpose and having vision and having and being in relationship. So I sort of haven't let it bother me here. You know, I'm having a wonderful time. People have been gracious to me. You know, some of my best friends are academics, you know?
Yes, please.
Hi, I'm 68, live in Arlington, very low income, living in state subsidized housing now. I know I had to be here to meet you. I don't know why. I'm grateful that you are here. What I want to ask is a brief question. This is it. What you just said is about passion. I have no money, I have great passion, and I hope to live long enough to continue to contribute that. what I want to ask is, some time ago I saw a note in a newspaper, Swanee Hunt as ambassador to the United Nations. How about it? Would you like that job? And is there any chance that we will see you so seated?
Thank you. That's very, very kind. You know, I actually have thought about that job, which I think is pretty terrible. Friends of mine who know the job, they say it is so, I mean, you're so involved with protocol all the time. Actually, Hillary had thought of me, I'm told, by her chief of staff, to be her chief of protocol. And I said, oh, please, you know, I mean, I can't imagine a worse fit for me. But I appreciate your confidence in me that your question implies. I'll tell you what would be great about that job is if the person used it as a platform and really had an agenda for making a difference in the world. Dick Holbrook did a good job there when he took on AIDS in Africa. And he said, you know, AIDS is a foreign policy threat. It's a security threat. He did a very important speech to the UN saying that AIDS is a security threat. And if I ever were to find myself in, once again in that kind of platform, political platform, I would think long and hard about why it is that the world has such an economic discrepancy. You know, you should not be living with the economic concerns that you have. I'm so glad. I bet you're happier than a lot of these tenured professors here. You know, and I'll tell you what, if I were to do just a random cut of all the people I know and cut across socioeconomic, I promise you that the happiness quotient would not be higher among the people with the most money. It would not. So that's, I think, what I would work on is, yeah. Oh, you know, that is so far out there that I really, let me just put it, I don't spend my time that way thinking about it. But I really appreciate your thoughts.
Next question, please. We have time just for a couple more.
This is maybe a little bit of a tough question, but I want to introduce it by saying that I think you've no doubt done some admirable things with your money, including the one that comes to mind for me, the Landmarks Orchestra, I believe, is something you've supported. However, there was an instance that was a little bit troubling to me that I would like to ask you about, and I'm not even sure that you and maybe even some of the other participants quite knew what the money was going for. Back in 2000, running in the run-up to the 2004 election, I'm sure this will probably ring a bell at some point as I describe it, Howard Dean was running in the Iowa caucuses, and a
it
guy...
It was horrible. I know exactly what you're going to say.
Okay, so what? Just so other people, so other people understand, just the broad outline. A guy raised some money, did a focus group, found out that liberal voters in Iowa, if they found out that that Howard Dean had been endorsed by the NRA up in Vermont, in circumstances arguably specific to Vermont, if they found that out, they maybe wouldn't view him so favorably. And this person raised some money and ran an ad based on the information gleaned from the focus group, and also ran another ad, I think, in South Carolina with an image of bin Laden. And was quite, I heard him talk months later about it, and he was quite proud of what he'd done. It was just a little distressing in its own right. But the contributors, there were a few contributors, and when I looked with interest when it was finally revealed who the contributors had been, and you turned up on the list, and I was... And I guess I suspect you may not have been aware of exactly what was up. And I'd just be interested to hear you talk about that.
Sure. Yeah. Could I begin with the Landmarks Orchestra?
Okay.
I am, give myself some time. No. I hope that Charles and I feel like we are each other's supporters because we love each other a lot. But I don't financially support the Landmarks Orchestra. That's really his deal. And it's really important that in our lives we have separate deals. And so that's, but I'm there in the audience, and I bring picnics, and I invite my friends. Now, I have a whole I have a pot of money that I set aside every year for political giving, and some goes to candidates and some goes to projects, and I have a staff person who helps figure that out. And we thought this looked really good. You know, we give to various candidates, but it's also to Emily's List and to, you know, larger groups like that. And what this person said, or this organization said they were doing with that money, seemed quite fair to us. And when we saw the ad, which was actually months later after the contribution, as the race heated up, we saw an ad that I was furious about. I wrote a heated letter to them. And I'll tell you that 2 years later, that when it came time and various different organizations were coming to me and saying, well, will you support this ad campaign that's going to do this and that youth, and this other, I said, you know, I'm not doing ad campaigns. I have been so burned. I am finding other ways because I can't control those ads. So I felt as bad about it as you did.
What had the person told you?
I don't remember, but I'll tell you, it was about, it was generally in terms of progressive politics, but it was not going to be something that, I think the negative advertising, by the way, is one of the blights on our political system, because, I mean, you have a choice. Are you going to vote for the crook or are you going to vote for the liar? I mean, and so you stay home. I think it suppresses the voter turnout. So I will never support negative advertising if I can help it.
Next question, please.
Hi, Swanee.
Hi.
You mentioned when you were young how the political right and the evangelical groups were sort of converging.
Right.
And then over time, it sounds like you've moved from, I'm not sure you were at political right at that age, but certainly towards the liberal side.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, what about the other side, the other dimension?
Well, that was really hard for me because I so identified the political right at that point than with the evangelicals. But what helped me enormously was Jim Wallis and Sojourners. Do you all know about Jim Wallis? He's written two books. One is called God's Politics, and the other is, or maybe this is just the subtitle of God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. And it's basically saying that the, quote, liberal agenda is the New Testament agenda. And you don't have to be a non-believer to think that you ought to care for prison reform and feed the hungry and raise the minimum wage. I mean, raising the minimum wage would be completely consistent with New Testament teaching. Anyway, Jim was the person who sort of set a stake out there that I could reach toward and keep much of my faith and still move politically. Yeah.
Last question, please.
Hi, Swanee. The last time I saw you, I believe you encouraged me to, next time I was at a forum, stand up and ask a question, so I'm here doing so this evening. In speaking about women in politics, you've spoken a lot about the inclusion of women in the political process and how you believe it contributes to security, among other things, and that having that perspective. So as a female ambassador, I was wondering what your ideas about the role and also the need for women in American diplomacy and international diplomacy and foreign policy is.
Sure. When you talk about women and men, you're never talking about one particular woman or one particular man. I mean, if we start talking about women being more collaborative, you'll always find people who say, yeah, right, well, what about Margaret Thatcher, you know? Or what about Indira Gandhi, Golda Meir, you know? And any woman who makes it to the top of a man's pyramid is probably more competitive than the men that she made it over. The difference comes when you get about 30 to 35 or 40% women.
Critical mass.
It is a critical mass and a tipping point, and to use all of those phrases. And what's interesting, Anita Gradin, who's a friend of mine who was ambassador to Vienna from Sweden, she had been a senator. And she said, you know, she was a senator when 10% of the Senate was women. She was also a senator when about 40% of the Senate was women. She said the same women in the 10%, when they were in 40%, they dressed, spoke, acted, voted differently. Even those same women, because they were in a larger group, they weren't having to make the same compromises, have the same tactics about how to, you know, to get a job done. And the other thing is it started pulling the men once you have a large enough group. So it's really important to get the numbers up. And, we, you know, people say, oh, this is the year of the women in American politics. I say, yeah, we went from 14% to 16%. Huh. You know, so I don't want us to be too heady about this. But when you do get women in this larger percentage, what happens, and I'm just talking research-wise, what happens is the military spending goes down, the spending for education, the spending for health care goes up. And in terms of the effect that has on foreign policy, and the old adage, when the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. Well, when the only tool you have for a really big problem is a military, then every situation out there looks like it's appropriate for military intervention. And we don't feel like we have other great options.
Thank you very much, Swanee.
Is this the end?
Actually, I would like to ask you a question.
Okay. There you go.
And since I'm the director here, I'll take that privilege from you, Mr. Abt. I would like to ask you to follow up a little bit on your last thought. I could ask a very large general question, what do you think the world would look like when more women are in charge? But I'd like to ask you something more specific before that. How do men react in general to the idea that the life would be different, politics would be different, foreign policy would be different if there were more women in charge, if there were more women solving these problems? Right now we seem to have a huge military interest, and we seem to be very willing to look at a lot of problems around the world as though the military is the only way to solve them. Do you see any kind of, you know, defensiveness, backlash in that position? And how do you think that might play out?
The backlash is a really important question. South Africa, which has the highest number of women in leadership positions, government and others, has probably the highest rape statistics in the world. I mean, it is horrible. And when you talk to South African women leaders, they say that they believe that men, as they're feeling less power in public places, are angry and are asserting that against women in privacy. So backlash is very serious. When I'm going to first say a sort of negative. After shock and awe, I went over to the Pentagon. I was talking to the general who was in charge of the operations in Iraq, and I said, look, you've got to start including the women. You've had meetings with future Iraqi leaders. You had over 500 men. You had seven women out of the 500. You've got to start including the women in the decision-making here. And he said, oh, Madam Ambassador, thank you so much for taking your time to come. I'm so sorry I kept you waiting. Would you like some more coffee? And then he said, thank you. After we get the place secure, we can think about women's issues. And I said, look, I'm not talking about breast cancer or cervical cancer. I'm talking about, those are women's issues, okay? I'm talking about getting the place secure. And I spent an hour talking with him until he finally seemed to at least understand the concept, but not that he did anything about it. I said, you know, the women will know where the 16-year-olds are with the weapons under their mattresses. They know where the disaffected and angry 18-year-olds are. That's the kind of things that they know. They have their fingers on the pulse of the community. You must include them. Now, when I say things like that, if it's in an institutional setting, often there's resistance. But privately, men nod their heads. And there seems to be an understanding that they carry around. And maybe it's because they think about their mothers, or they think of, you know, who were making the peace in the family, or whatever it was. But it's amazing how many men say to me, you know, this would be a better world if women were running it. Now, I'm not arguing for women to run the world, but I am arguing that we need a balance, and we aren't even close to the balance. Worldwide, 17% of the ministers are women. By ministers, I mean government ministers, and of those, almost all of them are ministers of gender. So, meaning ministries of women's affairs. I'll leave you with the last vignette.
Oh, may I add a footnote?
Yes, please.
I've spent some time in Scandinavia, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, where there's a larger percentage of women in government and in the professions. As a matter of fact, currently 70% of the medical students in Scandinavia are female. And they're the most progressive and peaceful countries. So that reinforces Swanee's belief. I might say, speaking for myself, I was skeptical of this idea 5 or 6 years ago. But over the years, talking with Swanee, she has thoroughly persuaded me on the merits of the argument that she's quite right, and that at least equal participation of women in government all over the world would promote peaceful conflict resolution and more socially constructive ways of dealing with our problems than the male-dominated power structure does today. And I speak as a social scientist who is concerned with these issues and has been studying them. So I think she's right, and I hope you'll all support her concept.
And the last image I'll leave you is the one, am I swearing in, where I was on this stage at the Ben Franklin Room, and you all were out there, friends and colleagues, and Al Gore was standing there to swear me in, and Charles was standing right behind, being the supportive husband, and there was Strom Thurmond. Remember Strom Thurmond? And there was Bob Strauss. Remember Robert Strauss, you know, the head of the DNC? And to have the two of them in that room together, both from my childhood days. And I was standing there, and I have this wonderful picture, so that's why it's so vivid in my memory. I'm standing there with my oath of, giving my oath of office, and who's holding the Bible? But my mom, who had shrunk from 5'4 to 4'10, you know, so she's looking up at me like this, and she, with the most adoring eyes, the most adoring eyes. And in my speech to the crowd, I said, oh, Mom, aren't you glad Dad isn't alive to have to witness this, me going into a Democratic, you know, administration? You know, and people were laughing, and I just thought, somehow or another, we have got to find that ability to laugh and that ability to adore, to laugh and to love, even across the divides. That's also what the book is about. So thank you so much for being here.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Visit Britain, with information on how to be a Brit different on vacation. Details at visitbritain.com/US. And from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.